going to start the meeting because we have a very long agenda, and so I am going to be asking people to think very carefully about what you're saying and try to keep it as concise as possible, not repeat information. We also, unfortunately, have a lot of competing committee meetings going on at the same time, so people will be coming in and out. I promise you I'll sit through the whole thing, because I'm very interested in this issue and am interested in what you have to communicate. So today is an informational hearing on transmission issues, and we will start with Clara Moeller, who is Vice President of Transmission Asset Management, or MISO. Mr. Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today I have some remarks that are an update of the situation around the generation interconnection queue and transmission
associated. Mr. Moeller, I'm going to ask you to pull the microphone just a little bit closer.
Sure. Thank Sorry you. About that. Can you hear me now?
Ken? Yes.
Oh, no, that'd be in communications, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, that's this committee, too.
Okay. So this is an update of similar kinds of topics that I talked about last time I was before your committee, and I appreciate the opportunity to do so. The Minnesota wind mandate, as it's been estimated in terms of how many megawatts of connected wind machines are necessary to meet the mandate in its entirety, is between 5,000 and 7,000 megawatts of connected wind machines. The difference in those estimates is rather wide. It's the difference between the average capacity factor, or how much energy a given machine puts out based on the wind at a given location. What's important about that is the difference between the 5,000 megawatts and the 7,000 megawatts is on the order of $400 million. In terms of what the installed cost of those additional 2,000 megawatts of generators are. So as we do this job of finding transmission and appropriate wind machines, it's important to understand both the size and how quickly this is growing. That mandate represents a compounded growth rate of about 22% per year. Inside the Midwest ISO queue and in collaboration with the transmission owners in the area, we have worked already to establish interconnections for a substantial amount of generation towards meeting the wind mandate. There is a lot of talk about the problems in the generation interconnection queue. In part, that's because there are 10 times as many projects seeking to be connected as are necessary to meet the wind mandate. So there's some turbulence between supply and demand in that regard. Again, up to 7,000 megawatts to meet the wind mandate. We currently have 25,000 megawatts of requests of people to connect to the transmission grid. So that's what's causing some of the stress in the system. In the Midwest ISO in total, there's 62,000 megawatts of requests for wind interconnection. The bar to the left represents what we call a reference case, which is an estimate of what amount of what sorts of generations might be coming in order to meet the aggregate needs of the Midwest ISO footprint. The 12,600 number that is in green is the summation of the three legislated wind portfolio standards, our estimate of those needs in our footprint. Those three states that have a legislated mandate include Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois. There is a legislated wind mandate in Iowa, but it is quite small and has already been met. So the dilemma that we have and that we're facing around transmission issues is we have 61,000 megawatts of folks that would like to connect, and we have what we know is 12,600 megawatts of renewable portfolio standards to meet, and it's hard to discern where between those two numbers an appropriate amount of infrastructure is. Our experience in the wind interconnection queue, actually interconnection queue in aggregate, which includes wind, is about 70% of projects that request interconnection ultimately drop out. So that turbulence also makes it difficult for utilities to decide how much transmission investment is an appropriate amount. The middle bar there, the 40,500, is a simulation that we did that looked at what if there were a 20% wind mandate in every state that the Midwest ISO market serves. So that would be, our estimate would be 40,000 megawatts of connected wind machines. And again, you can see that we have almost 62,000 megawatts of requesting interconnection. So it's that mismatch that is causing a certain amount of turbulence. This statistic is a different slice. Yes, ma'am.
Senator Rosen has
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mueller, can you again that you said 70% who request connection drop out?
That has been our historical actual understanding, yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Can you tell me what are some of the reasons that they go through the formal process and they drop out, or how far does this request go?
Mr. Mueller?
Madam Chair, yes, ma'am. The reasons vary. It can be inability to achieve financing. It can be that the interconnection costs are so large that the economics of the project are no longer viable. It can be they failed to achieve a power purchase agreement for the outtake. There's a myriad of reasons. No one reason seems to be dominant.
You can continue, Mr. Mueller.
Thank you, ma'am. As you can see, the requests for interconnection have grown exponentially across the last several years. We had sufficient amounts of wind energy in our queue to meet the legislated wind mandates in 2006 at 14,000 megawatts. We have since then increased an additional 46,000 megawatts of requests for interconnection. So that is what is behind many of the comments around the queue and its problems. The infrastructure that is in place in many of the locations where the wind resource is the richest is infrastructure that was constructed to serve fairly modest amounts of consumer load on the order of 50 or 80 megawatts of load. With a substantial amount of wind, the infrastructure is simply not there and not available. In terms of historical generation interconnections that we have approved by state, that's what this particular graph represents. You can see in Minnesota there have been about 2,800 megawatts of wind, a substantial amount of gas, and a small amount of coal has been approved for interconnection up until this point in time. It's interesting to note that of the 2,800 megawatts of wind that has been approved for interconnection, 1,100 megawatts of that wind is currently in a state that we call suspension. That is, all the paperwork is done, the transmission facilities have been identified that need to be constructed to accommodate this wind, and yet the projects have taken a pause. And underneath the queuing rules, they have an opportunity to take that pause for up to 3 years. Unfortunately, that causes the folks that are waiting in line to have to wait for them to make up their mind. Now, I am aware of in a couple of cases where the utility that would be required to make the transmission upgrades for these projects that are in suspended position is proceeding to make the transmission investments anyway, but they are doing that at some financial risk to themselves.
Mr. Mueller,
yes, ma'am.
Are there people that are in the line behind those who are in the three-year suspension?
Yes, ma'am.
Who could they leapfrog over them?
Not according to the queuing rules, no, ma'am.
And the queuing rules are federal rules? Or?
Federal rules. There was a substantial rulemaking at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission where the queuing rules were developed on a national basis. The notion of what fair is came out as first in, first out. So until these projects make up their mind, the projects behind them, we can do a study, we can see what additional transmission might be necessary. But depending on whether these suspended projects go forward or don't go forward, the amount of transmission investment that these later queued projects would be required could be dramatically different in terms of its cost, from $1 million to $10 million kind of economic swings.
Is there anything that is being done to look at this process to see if there's a way of speeding up those behind?
Yes, ma'am. We are currently involved and have been involved across the last 8 or 9 months in a process that attempts to redesign the queuing process, and in specific around the suspension rules, we would only allow suspensions in a force majeure event.
In a what?
In a force majeure event.
We and will be what making, is that?
A flood comes and wipes out the spot you were going to put your generator turbine. You know, those sorts of things.
Okay.
We will be making that filing in May at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to request that they change their rules to accelerate that queue. Unfortunately, because of the big mismatch between infrastructure and queued requests, while we'll be able to speed that queue up some, the real problem has to do with finding enough infrastructure to outlet. I've got a couple slides later where I'll revisit that.
And Mr. Mueller, has this been a problem in the past, or is this only as we're trying now to get all the renewable energy up and going, where people taking a 3-year hiatus has slowed down the process of getting transmission moving?
It is particularly difficult in connecting wind machines. The queue rules, the implicit assumption that was in the folks' mind when they arrived at the original queue rules were focused on fairly small generators in load centers, so a combustion turbine near a city, so that the amount of transmission involved was tens of miles, and the size of the generator was small compared to the load. In the case of the wind requests, they tend to be between 200 and 600 miles away from the load, and so we have 200 to 600 miles of transmission issues. And then also the requested interconnections are very large compared to the load in the region that they're seeking to interconnect.
So this is a relatively new problem that has arisen?
Yes, we started to worry about the problem in earnest in 2006. In 2007, as you can see from this graphic, the request order of magnitude increased, and so this problem became manifest in a very loud way through 2007, and that's why we're where we are.
And how long does it take to change the rule if you wait? You said that you're going to be making a request to change the rule. How long is that likely to take if they agree with you?
In terms of changing the rule set, it's probably 60 to 90 days. But then there's a transition problem between folks that have applied underneath the old rule set will want the old rule set if they happen to be in the front of the line. And so there'll be a bunch more turbulence between when we get the rules changed and when we get through this. And in no case will the rules change help the fact that we've got room for 2,000 megawatts of wind to connect, and we've got 25,000 megawatts that would like to connect.
Okay. Senator Rosen?
Yes, Mr.
Mueller, that state of a suspension is those 1,100 megawatts that are in a state of suspension, a lot of that's caused by the supply of the turbines and the blades and the lack of, or that has nothing to do with it?
Mr. Mueller? Thank you, ma'am. We're not in a position to know. We simply are notified by the project that they request suspension. They do not need to, in the current rules, they do not need to give us a reason.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rose.
Mr. Mueller, it would be nice to have a reason, though, wouldn't it, to
Mr. Roller?
Yes, ma'am. Policymakers, a reason would be very useful.
Okay. Go ahead.
This map with black dots on it, the black dots show where physically the interconnections are that we have approved since 2004.
Senator Kretner-Sullivan?
Senator Sharon?
I just would like to go back to this question that Senator Rosen asked. Is there a reason why you're not asking, or you're not allowed to ask, or is there a reason why the answer to that question would not want to be given?
Mr. Moeller.
Madam Chair, ma'am, the way the federal rules were derived included the developers of various projects. They found it to be in their commercial interest to not divulge those causes. And so the rules were written as they're written that causes them to not need to. That's why one of the changes we are going to ask for is that there has to be a specific reason that is substantive, like the turbine blades are on back order for 5 years, you know, so that there is a substantive reason before they can achieve that suspended status. So that is a gap we are trying to fill.
Okay, thank you. We'll try again.
Again, what I'm trying to show here is simply that while there are significant queue issues and there are a lot of frustrated folks wanting to connect, it's not like there hasn't been a lot of activity and a lot of things connected. The black dots here show where those 2,800 megawatts of interconnected requests have been approved. The green dots in the next map show where the pending requests are. So if you look at the two maps and kind of flip between them, you can see that the pending requests and the accepted requests are essentially in the same physical kinds of places. Mm-hmm. And so that's an indicator of why the transmission infrastructure in those places is substantially utilized. And it's because it's substantially utilized that we have these longer-term problems of infrastructure in order to meet the out-year kinds of goals. I'm not going to spend much time on this slide because we've talked about queue reform quite a bit. There's, you know, the three parts. There's the little P politics. I'm sorry, that's a big P. In terms of politics, one of the things that's important is that the public policy, the energy policy of the various states is not exactly coincident. And so as we look at a regional grid and trying to meet the needs of the Dakotas and Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa and Illinois, all the neighboring states, because their policies are in flux, it causes uncertainty around who should build how much infrastructure. And I know some of the other speakers behind me are going to spend a little time talking about that as well. Here's a specific example of things that are going on Buffalo Ridge through the year 2014.
The projects that are in place, the 345 kilovolt circuit and other circuits that are being proposed or have been proposed, including the Buffalo Ridge generator outlet upgrades, some of the CapEx projects that are either in process now or will be in process soon. The sum of all those projects yield about a 2,000 megawatt output capability from the area around Buffalo Ridge. You can see that we have requests for interconnection at 25,000 megawatts. A way to think about that is nominally to move 1,000 megawatts of energy takes up at least a 345 kilovolt line. So if we're willing to move 25,000 megawatts of energy, it'd be on the order of 345 kilovolt lines. So the infrastructure is substantial to meet these kinds of goals. The last place that much infrastructure was constructed, I think the applicant was Mr. Eisenhower. This is not an insignificant kind of infrastructure to accommodate these sorts of requirements. We have moved to grouping studies to try to accelerate the process. One of the difficulties with grouping studies is people still drop out in that 70% dropout rate. This particular example happens to be the Plum area in Michigan, where we started the process with 600 megawatts of capacity and 8 requests. We did some studies to see how much money it would cost to accommodate that. It would be $164 million. We refined that study, got it down to $122 million. And of the 7 requests, we got down to 3 fairly promptly because they didn't have the wherewithal to fund that much transmission. We worked the study some more. We got the $14 million to accommodate the 3 requests and 244 megawatts. Another project dropped out. And in the end, we had a process to spend. generation interconnection queue is a very efficient way to do transmission planning. And we would agree with that.
It's the interconnect.
So we have three time horizons. We have the immediate kinds of studies. That's the actual interconnection request itself. What does it take to get the project on? We are in the process of moving towards a midterm study where we're looking, trying to look out in the 2016-2020 kind of time frame so that we can anticipate the need for transmission and not wait for the queue project to try to drive it. We're just taking too much time here with the generation interconnection. And then the third thing we're doing is we're looking at some long-range kinds of things in order to try to bookend how big this might be in full. The targeted plan that I'm talking about here, the kickoff meeting for that is on Friday this week, where we're seeking to get the states that have the regulatory mandates, either load-serving entities or transmission investors in a room together, scope a study that looks at what would the minimum amount of transmission be that we could effectively make applications for, show need in front of the various commissions, and achieve construction. We believe by summing those RPS standards up, we can get started and not wait for the ultimate resolution of a national policy around that. So we expect by the end of
2008 to have a candidate list of what those projects might be, and we hope in 2009 there'll be projects that transmission owners are prepared to sponsor in regulatory proceedings to achieve construction. The last thing I'd like to say is this Joint Coordinated System Plan is a plan we are doing together with our neighbors to the west, south, and east with the Department of Energy sponsorship that is looking at how much wind should be exploited should the nation go to a 20% renewable portfolio standard for the entire nation. The preliminary numbers say that the Midwest ISO states should be expected to contribute about 90,000 megawatts of installed capacity should the nation move to a 20% mandate. Now, again, 90,000 megawatts when we're talking about infrastructure is an enormous amount of infrastructure. A 765 kV high capacity line is about $4 million a mile, and it takes about 250 foot of right-of-way side to side. That's the equivalent of a four-lane highway. Okay, rural construction and a four-lane highway is about $4 million a mile and a nominal right-of-way width of 220. So this is a very big deal in terms of the infrastructure that would be necessary to accommodate a national mandate in that 90,000 megawatt kind of range. And with that, I'd be delighted to take additional questions, ma'am.
Mr. Mueller, I realize that you oversee a much larger area than Minnesota, but are we on track to be able to meet our renewable energy goal? Are we going to be able to accomplish that?
At the current pace, I don't see significant risk through the early target years, 2012. Some things have to happen to make the 2016 numbers come true. And in the out years, we're going to have to discern what this more regional kind of transmission is that we need to build in order to accommodate it. One of the things that happens with a lot of wind trying to sink just in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area is the existing what we call baseload plants have an operating minimum. And if we get to where we have to push those below their operating minimum, we'll end up curtailing the wind because from a safety standpoint, it takes 2 or 3 days to turn that baseload plant back on. So taking it all the way to off isn't a very safe option in terms of reliability. So as we look at those larger numbers, we need to think about stronger connections to the rest of the region so that we don't have to drive those baseload steam plants down below their minimums.
Knowing now what our goals are for the future, is there planning that can be done at this stage in order for us to ensure more success in meeting our renewable energy goal?
That is this study that we intend to kick off on Friday.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Mueller, the study was the Joint Coordinated System Plan?
Yes, ma'am.
And when is this plan supposed to be done?
The results should be available in June or July of 2009.
And, Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Can you just give us briefly where the nation's at with their 20% mandate? With the discussion, just review that.
Yeah, in terms of the legislation, I'm not aware of that. What I do know is that the Department of Energy has been tasked to do an evaluation of what a 20% mandate would be, where the wind would effectively be sited, and what transmission would be necessary in order to make it safe and effective. And their preliminary results indicated that our part of the footprint, predominantly in the west, because that's where our wind resources are the richest, would be expected to contribute about 90,000 megawatts to that 20% mandate.
Senator Alcine.
Madam Chair, thank you. I guess this isn't much of a surprise to me because I remember last year we had a lot of discussion about the estimated cost for the for rebuilding the grid was like $6 billion. That kind of sticks in my mind. And I thought there was also talk about like some major lines running to Illinois for the wind. But I guess my question is, like the new hybrid plant that's a gas plant, isn't that designed to be more of a peaking type plant to adjust to different variations?
Mr. Mueller.
Yes, ma'am. One of the values of the change in hybrid from coal to gas is its dispatchable range is more broad than a typical coal plant. So in terms of the ability to follow wind as a resource, it is more effective than a coal plant would be at doing that job. In the case of High Bridge, most of its energy is consumed quite locally.
Any further questions? Well, then I thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'd like to call now on Laura McCartan and Will Call from CapEx 2020. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here today and give you an update on our CapEx activities. My name is Will Call. I'm with Great River Energy. I serve as the Transmission Vice President, and I'm also the Chairman of the CapEx Project. And with me today is Laura McCartan with Xcel, and she is the Director of Regional Transmission Development at Xcel and also the co-executive director of the CapEx project. She spends her days, all day, every day, on implementation of our projects. We just have a couple of points we want to cover today. We know your time is minimal. We'd like to give you an update on CapEx and where we are. We think we have a real success story to share with you. I think we have probably the largest regulatory application before the commission that's ever happened in the history of the state. 700 miles of 345 and 230 kV lines, $1.7 billion. And those are proceeding, and I think we're doing a very good job of reaching out to the public. Laura will address those. We also want to talk about how we're doing with respect to the RES milestones, 2010, 2012, 2016, and beyond. And we also want to talk a little bit about the CapEx approach to transmission planning. We think it's a very important item to be considering right now, that it's an integrated and comprehensive approach. Is not a special interest approach. We're trying to do something that's going to be the most economical overall, that meets all of the needs of the system, including reliability and generation interconnect. So with that, I'll hand it over to Laura.
Thank you, Will, and thank you, committee members. I'd like to start with just a couple of remarks about the transmission grid. It's been called a complex machine, and that's a very apt description for the transmission grid. Our transmissions grid here in the state of Minnesota comprises almost 14,000 miles of transmission lines. and connects almost 175 generating plants. So it serves multiple purposes. It connects generation to customer load centers, such as cities, delivers the energy to the customers who need it. It delivers renewable energy to customers and helps us meet the state policy. And it provides an overall backbone of reliability for the electric delivery system. The transmission grid is designed to be robust and redundant, and that is reflected in the fact that it's an interconnected system, not only within the state of Minnesota, but also to our surrounding states and to Canada. And there's a lot of redundancy built in so that the system is able to withstand the loss of any generating plant or a portion of the transmission system and still continue to provide reliable service to customers. So it's a complex system. It requires sophisticated planning, design, and operation to keep it running well. And that's a very important part of what the utilities here in the state accomplish. CapEx 2020 is, I hope some of you still remember that term. It refers to capacity expansion needed by the year 2020. This reflects the timing. In about 2004, utilities in the state came together. We recognized that there were reliability needs, that we hadn't really done major infrastructure investment here in the state transmission system for almost 25 years, and we needed to do something to address reliability and to build a foundation to meet customer growing energy needs as well as growing use of renewable energy. So we worked together on a plan to do exactly that, and we are today an alliance of 11 utilities that serve the state and the surrounding area. It includes cooperatives, municipals, and investor-owned utilities. I have a copy of a presentation here that I will hand out to you, but in the interest of time, I won't read through all of them, but you will have that information available to you. One thing we're very, very proud of is what's underway now, as Will mentioned, is we're going forward with the first four projects that we identified are needed for the state to build into the future here. We call those our Group 1 projects. As Will mentioned, nearly 700 miles and $1.7 billion of new transmission lines for the state. One of those lines is between Bemidji and Grand Rapids to the north. Another one is between Fargo, North Dakota, and the Monticello area. The third is between Brookings, South Dakota, and the Twin Cities area. And the fourth is between the Twin Cities area to Rochester and La Crosse. These four projects serve multiple needs. They address reliability issues in localized areas such as the Bemidji area, St. Cloud, Alexandria, Rochester. They also start to build the foundation of an expanded transmission system needed to meet our customers' growing energy needs and also needed to tap renewable energy where it is found, say western Minnesota, and deliver it to the customer load centers such as the Twin Cities. As we have gone forward with these first four projects, they have been subject to an extensive public process in sort of two prongs. One prong is the utilities that are working together on these four projects from the get-go realize that a very comprehensive outreach to the public was necessary for the success of these. This is a big deal, 700 miles, there's a lot of impact, and we wanted to make sure that we connected very well with the public, explained what these projects were about, and also listened to what concerns and questions they had of us. So starting about a year ago, we have, through the course of the last year, conducted close to 50 public meetings about these projects and to get input from the public. We have done mailings and kept in close communication with, it's about 73,000 landowners in the state of Minnesota that fall within what we call very broad study corridors associated with each of these projects. We wanted anybody potentially impacted to know what was going on and have an early opportunity to get involved. They've received at least four mailings from us over this period, and we continue to work with the public going forward into the public review process. There's also very expansive regulatory proceedings underway, and this started with, I guess I call it the mother of all regulatory applications, the Certificate of Need. And that was filed with the Public Utility Commission in August of 2007. That process is well underway and is on target and on schedule. We believe that we've made a good case for these projects, and that will, if that is borne out by the Certificate of Need, we expect to get that approval in early 2009. We're looking to file applications for routes for these 700 miles of new transmission later this year. And again, we're looking for those permits to come to us in late 2009 or perhaps early 2010. Once we have those, we can move into land acquisition and start construction. And we're looking at in-service dates for these first four projects between the years 2013 and 2015. There are also reviews underway in Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, and with a federal agency. So that's what's happening with projects underway, and those projects will help us meet our 2016 milestones, which we'll talk about more later. There's also a work that's been going on as set up by the 2007 Renewable Energy Standard legislation that was passed a year ago. One of the very important things that's happening because of that legislation is analysis is underway to relook at what transmission needs are there to meet the 2016 milestones. The legislature here passed one of the most advanced renewable energy standards in the nation, and it has a definite impact on what transmission needs to be built to serve and support that. So later this year, by December, we will have a blueprint for transmission that needs to be built to meet the 2016 milestone. Later in 2009, there will be analysis completed that will provide a vision for looking beyond 2016. In addition, there are some other studies I won't go into, but all of this is being coordinated with other regional planning efforts and study work. The legislature also directed that a study of distributed renewable generation be done, looking at how to optimize the interconnection and delivery of small distributed renewable generation projects. That work is close to being complete, and in June of this year, a report will be issued that will report the results of analysis of the first 600 megawatts of DRG projects. And we're very hopeful and looking forward to that and looking to accommodate that and incorporate such projects into utilities to help them to help us meet our milestones going forward. At this point, I'll just turn it over to Will.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Call.
Yes, ma'am. I want to talk about the milestones and our prospects for meeting those milestones, the 2010-2012 milestones I'll talk about first. And we have existing capacity in the system or projects that are currently in the pipeline that we anticipate will get us to the 2010 and 2012 milestones. We're very confident about that. We have the CapEx Group 1 projects that Laura just talked about ready and going through the pipeline, the regulatory pipeline. And then we have another group of projects we call Group 1A or Group 1B, but it's a similar scale of 345 kV development that we are in the process of completing the studies, and those studies will be done at the end of this year. With those projects and the Group 1 projects, we expect that we will be able to achieve the 2016 milestones. And that's all pretty much within our business model and the planning effort we've been doing all along. But I think the main thing I really wanted to talk about today, and Claire hit on it a little bit, was what happens after 2016. And we are developing a strategy for dealing with that. We call it the bridge strategy. And the bridge strategy refers to bridging forward to the year 2025, to that milestone, but also refers to a geographic bridge. And now we're starting to look at the broader market within MISO. Claire mentioned we have maybe to meet all of our milestones, a 6,000 megawatt capacity we need to hook up. If you look in all of MISO right now, it's maybe 14 or 15,000 megawatts, and there could be a national renewable portfolio standard that would make it even greater. So we need to do a coordinated planning effort that goes beyond our geography and beyond this market in Minnesota. And so we are doing that. And I will say that the technical challenges are significant. Claire was talking about 765 kV voltage, and the cost of that is very significant. So there's also economic challenges, and then there's also political challenges. Our work so far has been primarily within this political jurisdiction, and we are unified behind this policy, and we're dedicated to achieving the goals there. As we move beyond Minnesota into a broader area, then we have other political jurisdictions, other utilities, and other interests that need to be taken into account. And then finally, we have Congress working on potentially a cap-and-trade program or a national RPS. We don't expect that we will know what the national policy is until maybe 2010. And so we're probably going to need, that's going to inform what we do substantially, and we're paying very close attention to that. But in the meantime, there are a number of parallel efforts going on that bridge beyond Minnesota. And one effort is within MISO, and Claire mentioned this meeting on Friday. We are going to be meeting with other MISO members who are interested in developing the plan for a grander build-out that goes to serve the MISO broader market, and a tariff for how we're going to pay for it. And again, Claire talked about the cost. It's very significant. We have commissions in every state that are going to need to be in line for that to go through. We also have the Midwest Governors Association, and they had a summit last fall. They have a strategy around transmission and expanding transmission to develop renewable energy. We're getting involved in that, and we think that is probably a very important forum for being able to accomplish what we need to do in a broader geographic area. And finally, there's the Organization of MISO States, which is a group of public utility commissioners that meet regularly and review issues in the region. A coordination in that group is going to be absolutely critical for utilities to recover their costs. So I guess what I'm saying here is that Beyond 2016 is a special challenge. We're doing everything we can to anticipate it. It's bringing in a lot of new players, and we do have some welcome new players here in Minnesota that we're looking forward to work with. I think later on we'll be hearing from Doug Collins from ITC, Independent Transmission Company. They recently acquired the assets of Alliant in southern Minnesota and in Iowa. And so we welcome their help. We need their help. We have American Transmission Company in Wisconsin. We'll also be working very closely with them. With that, I think I will end my remarks.
You seem upbeat about the process and everything. I'm wondering if there are any particular challenges that you're concerned about.
We've been very successful so far, and we're trying to keep that going. It's as we move along and get into these new projects, I think the biggest challenge that we have is the cost allocation issue among the utilities. And the MISO tariff right now isn't quite serving us the way we need to. We need to kind of figure out amongst ourselves and also in cooperation with the Minnesota Public Utility Commission on how we're going to allocate those costs among different consumer groups. I think that's the main challenge. I would say that out in the outstate areas where these lines are being routed, I'd say that we are cautiously saying so far so good. I'm not sure what the limit is of how many corridors we can build. I think it's a very important concern that we all need to be aware of. There is a limit of how many the public would be willing to put up with. But so far, so good. I think those are the two main concerns.
Mm-hmm. Any concerns about being able to meet the renewable energy standard?
We're confident we're going to meet those standards.
And I think we've heard from our partners that 2010, 2012, they all have plans in place and are confident they will meet those dates. And when the study work comes out later this year, we'll have a blueprint for 2016, and we have the time to work on that to get those projects in place for 2016. And then I think we just keep taking it in steps and then keep resetting our vision based upon the best information we have, looking out again over a 5 to 10 year period, and then keep adjusting and building the right plan.
One thing I would like to add, if I can,
Mr. Call.
The distributed resources study that Laura mentioned earlier, and George Cracker will be up here later on today, we've got surprisingly good results there. And so that does diminish the need for new transmission. It does give us many opportunities for smaller wind developments in specific places. And so when that report comes out in June, you'll see that there are a lot of opportunities out there that we frankly didn't anticipate.
Any, Senator Olsen?
Madam Chair, did you say you had a handout for us?
Yes.
Madam Chair, yes, we'll get that distributed right now.
And I guess my question is, I thought I saw down along Highway or 94 in southern Minnesota a new power line, like on the south side, mm-hmm. but that's nowhere near like a 745 line. I thought that was for Buffalo Ridge, but could you update me on that?
Ms. McCart.
Madam Chair, that's probably part of the XL Energy project. I think we call it 825 wind project. It was a 345 kV structure. That may be what you're thinking about. I can't be certain, but we could follow up with you afterwards and get in touch with someone who could answer your question precisely, if you'd like.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Caller. A little more detail on the public reception and how is that going? Because for a while there, years back, there seemed to be a lot of resistance to these transmission lines. So I'm just out of curiosity, are people aware of our goals in the state, and are they coming to these meetings with questions that are they approachable?
Mr. Call.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was a young lad back when the HVDC line was routed, and I was actually working for the state agency that routed it. And I was there for that very difficult time, and so was George Cracker. So we share that history.
I'm still here.
Yes. And so am I. Anyway, let's just say that we learned a lot of lessons from that, and we have done. In fact, we have an award-winning communication program for the CapEx project, and we made a point of going out and introducing ourselves and the project to the community outside of the state process. We had open houses. We notified. Was it how many? 73,000.
73,000.
Yeah. And, you know, we didn't get as good a turnout as we would have liked, but almost universally the response we got was that they appreciated the outreach, and we are continuing to do that. We're now going through a process where we're having open houses for them to come in and help us route the line. And so far, I would say it's just going very well. But I think the hard part is still ahead, though. When we have a specific route identified, people get a lot more energy around that. But so far, so good.
Okay, thank you for your comments. And we'll go to our next speaker, who is Teresa Mogensen from XL. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and the Energy Committee. My name is Teresa Mogensen, and my title at Xcel Energy is Director of Transmission Asset Management and Business Relations. And I'm here today to give you some remarks from the Xcel Energy Transmission perspective about things that we are doing to support the state goals and make sure that we can achieve them. First of all, let me begin by saying that Xcel Energy strongly supports Minnesota state energy policy as exemplified in the renewable energy standards and associated activities. We have continued to be very active in transmission studies and plan development. We have continued to be very active in transmission construction. And we have a continued willingness to do what is necessary to achieve the standards that you seek in a reliable, cost-effective, and timely manner. We think those aspects are all very important aspects, that reliable, cost-effective, and timely, so that we can achieve these energy policy goals. What has Xcel done already? Since spring 2003, we have invested over $300 million to build a variety of facilities to support the Minnesota State Transmission System. Included are 118 miles of new 115 and 161 kV lines, 35 miles of 345 kV lines, which was related to the question that we just had, your question, that is Xcel Energy facilities, 345 kV lines associated with what we call the 825 wind project. That was 35 miles of 345 kV lines, and we also are continuing for a total of 86 miles of 345 kV that will be in service by this summer. And we have also upgraded 96 miles of 115 kV lines. So a significant amount of investment over the past 5 years. And all total, that has added to the capacity that we already have of about 600 megawatts worth of wind outlet capacity we've created with those investments. And what are we doing right now to continue? First off, you heard that Xcel Energy is a major participant in the CapEx planning activities and investments, and also in the Minnesota Transmission Order planning activities. What we're trying to do with all of those is really seek the most efficient and effective mix of transmission projects to meet multiple needs. So meet the needs of the RES projects, the standards, meet the needs to serve load growth, meet the needs to interconnect new generation, whole variety of things that we're trying to do. The best way to do that is build an efficient set of projects that addresses multiple needs, and that's what we attempt to do. We are working to support Xcel Energy's renewable energy plan, which was filed in December of 2007. And that plan calls for a balanced portfolio of owned wind resources, contracted through power purchase agreement wind resources, and community-based energy development seabed wind resources, plus the necessary transmission capacity additions to support those. So we're working on all those aspects right now. Related to those transmission capacity additions, over the next 3 years, we anticipate investing another $200 million in addition to the CapEx investments on additional projects to support that capacity. Some examples of those. We have already received regulatory approval for a transmission project that adds another 350 megawatts of additional wind outlet capacity in southwest Minnesota that will be in service by 2009. You might know that as the BRIGO projects or the Buffalo Ridge incremental generation outlet projects. We're also finalizing study work at this time for several additional transmission projects to be placed in service in the next few years, and we'll have some regulatory filings coming in later this year and early 2009. One of those is an upgrade of a transmission line in southern Minnesota, which will add several hundred megawatts of additional capacity. No filing will be needed for that one. Example of trying to get the most efficiency that we can out of existing facilities by doing cost-effective upgrades. We are also looking at a variety of transmission reinforcements in southeast Minnesota to add several hundred megawatts of new capacity. And also, as identified in the Minnesota Biennial Transmission Plan, the Blue Lake Granite Falls Transmission Corridor is planned as the next major corridor to be developed after the CapEx lines. On top of investments associated with renewable energy standards, we also are building those investments upon what we call a foundation plan of continuing Xcel Energy transmission investments that are necessary to meet reliability standards, that we must meet load growth, those kinds of things. And we are anticipating spending over $100 million over the next 3 years on approximately 32 projects affecting 520 to 620 miles of line. And finally, a bit on ongoing challenges. Some talk has come today about kind of the chicken and egg problem of generation and transmission development, particularly renewables. Transmission takes a long time in general to plan and permit and construct, and generation, especially wind generation, can be developed relatively quickly, and that can result in kind of a mismatch or a standstill, as some of the other testifiers stated. And when that happens, basically transmission, in order to be efficient and effective, doesn't want to develop where the generation isn't. So you're looking for some certainty there. Generation doesn't want to go where the transmission isn't because they might not be able to get their product to market. So you kind of have that chicken and egg problem. And we do support at Xcel, we support the concept of trying to develop a rational approach to linking renewable generation and transmission planning to facilitate that efficient and effective development that we all seek so we can meet these energy policy goals in a cost-effective manner. That will conclude my remarks.
Ms. Mogensen, how much renewable energy does Xcel have online at this point?
We have, at the end of 2007, 1,066 megawatts.
And how much have you got contracted for?
Out of that proportion? I don't have that figure for you, but we can certainly give you that subsequently.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably one.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, on the same issue, Ms. Mogensen,
You mentioned the filing in December that had a mixture of proposed XL-owned power purchase agreements with others and seabed-type projects. Can you break that down? Do you know what the percentages will be roughly?
What was filed was – I'm sorry. What was filed was approximately a third.
A third, a third, a third?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Roughly.
And that's the 1066, Madam Chair, is what you have currently in the ground or –
Ms. Mogensen?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's what we have under contract and operational at this point.
And so,
Senator Anderson,
maybe your question was, what when in your filing, how much more capacity is in that plan? How many more megawatts?
Ms. Mogensen.
Do you know offhand?
The amount of megawatts of renewable energy additions needed was calculated through a kind of a complicated algorithm to try and determine how much capacity do you need to get the amount of energy proportion that you want. Mm-hmm. So I do not have those numbers right offhand, but that amounts were calculated and filed in the biennial transmission plan report as well. So those numbers are available. So out of those numbers, Excel would, out of the requirements, we would plan to roughly seek one-third, one-third, one-third from those different sources.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on that 1066, I'm not sure what that means because I keep hearing that, you know, the wind doesn't blow at night or on a hot summer day. So when you say 1066, does that mean the average production from wind or at a certain time of day or a certain time of year?
Ms. Mogensen?
The 1066 is a capacity number, so that means that's the maximum amount that if all the wind was on that could be generated, and then you would translate that into an energy amount based on how many hours that capacity ran to get your megawatt hours. And ultimately, out of that, you would calculate your percentage of your total sales to see how much of your percent energy you were supplying from renewable sources.
Senator Olsen.
Do you have that percent?
Ms. Mogensen.
That I do not. I'm sorry. Okay. We can get that for you, though, as well.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Mogensen, a little bit later we are going to hear from Outland Renewable Energy, and they are proposing to have their own megawatts in their own transmission line that would serve that wind farm. And I could be wrong, but I think it's up to 600 megawatts, or is it more than that? But I'm just looking for your opinion on projects that serve their own a transmission line that serves a specific area.
Ms. Mogensen.
Well, as I said, in general, it's most efficient and effective if you can have projects that become part of a network to serve multiple needs, because then you have the network that is able to reinforce, facilities can reinforce each other, and you can do multiple things. You can bring in power from different places, you can serve different loads, and you're using your corridors to their maximum effect by trying to minimize the amount of corridors used in order to provide the capacity that you need for the system. So Excel supports an integrated approach to planning where we try and get the most possible out of every transmission corridor that we would construct and use, as do the other Minnesota transmission owners.
Senator Rosen? Madam Chair, thank you. But wouldn't you agree that it's been the network that has been the perhaps the stumbling block or has been portion of this whole project that's why we have these studies to find out how much we do have, the capacity, and here's a project that's coming online, that wants to come online, that wants to just serve their own farms and projects. I'm not quite sure, you know, why Excel would not want that as part of the future goal.
Ms. Mogensen.
I'm not saying that we don't want it or that we do want it. I'm just saying that if you're using up corridor space for a single purpose line, you may end up running additional lines to serve the rest of the network purposes. So there's certainly lots of opportunities for different approaches to address the lack of network capacity. That's one approach that, you know, may be workable and successful. Other approaches are to build a stronger network transmission grid and be able to utilize those facilities for multiple purposes. That's one of the fundamental stumbling blocks that Mr. Moeller said. There's just a fundamental lack of infrastructure, and then you get that chicken and egg thing about how do you choose the right way to develop so that you're doing it in an efficient way and you don't have stranded assets that aren't ultimately continuing to serve the needs of the public.
Senator Rosen, to follow up.
Yes, thank you. The corridor space, can you go into that a little further? Is there just so much, I mean, is it designated areas throughout the state that can be used for these lines, or what exactly do you mean by corridor space?
Ms. Mogensen.
That again, tends to be a siting issue, challenges with siting. When you're trying to route large facilities through communities, in general, communities would like to kind of corral those facilities in certain places. They don't generally want them all over if that can be avoided. So if you're going through perhaps a community multiple times for many different projects or purposes, you might get what we call corridor fatigue, where the public becomes, you know, unreceptive to continuing to site additional facilities. And so there's a limited amount of space perhaps that is best suited to host transmission lines. Certainly there's a lot of open space available, and it's a matter of community choices on that, but it tends to be certain places where communities prefer those facilities to be routed, and you can only go to the same well so many times, per se.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Mogensen, on top of Senator Olsen's comment about the amount that these wind turbines are actually running, I guess I would, if you're the right person, I would like to see some numbers on that too. And I would define it as if you could get us something like in manufacturing, you generally consider uptime and runtime. Uptime is when they're actually generating, or they could be generating if the wind is blowing. And runtime is how much of that time they're actually running. And then, you know, you can do mathematics to find out what the downtime is, unless there's something else that you include in it. But downtime would be whether or not the wind is blowing and they're not able to generate. So if you have a, for instance, a repair work or renovation, that would be a downtime. If you could get us some numbers like that, I would appreciate it, or at least steer us to the right person that we can get them from.
So maybe you could get that information to the committee administrator and we'll distribute it to the committee members. Thank
okay.
you. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, following up on Senator Rosen's question, this is a really basic question, but if you have a power line, big towers, and a wire, can you add another wire? I mean, can you just have multiple 345 lines in the same exact right-of-way?
Ms. Mogensen.
How much space do they take up?
It depends. You certainly can. The more wires you try and get in there, the taller and stronger and wider that the structures have to be. And there generally is a certain point where you don't want to have so many wires in a single corridor, because if something were to happen, tornado goes through and wipes out, you know, a structure, you're taking out four or five, you know, however many lines that might cause significant problems. So generally in planning a good network, you try and have some diversity in location so you don't have all your eggs in one basket. So that's really kind of the trade-off. You can fit multiple lines in a corridor as long as you have structures that are strong enough to support them, and as long as you plan your system with enough redundancy that if you lost that corridor, you would be okay to be able to serve the load that was there.
So, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Anderson.
Could you, I mean, it seems to me when we're at this phase now where we're above, we have more demand than we have lines, but there's a lot of planning and investment and more lines will be built. You know, couldn't you, how much do you usually have on one line on your major transmission lines? Is there more than one wire generally?
Ms. Mogensen.
In general, you may see two lines. Double circuit structures are quite common. Going beyond two lines, sometimes you see more in congested areas in city, you know, downtowns and things like that, where your corridor space is really at a premium. Then you kind of trade off again that risk. Mm-hmm. But then if you're in a more populated area, you're closer to resources to put it back together if something were to happen. That all those things come into play when you're trying to decide how much redundancy you need and how much corridor efficiency you can have by putting multiple facilities in a single corridor.
Okay, we're going to have to move along now at this point. I thank you for your comments. I would like to next call to the table Ingrid Bjorklund, Dennis Fultz, and Bob Gervais.
Hi, welcome. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ingrid Bjorklund with Outland Renewable Energy.
Hold the mic a little closer.
Is that good?
That's good.
Okay. As I said, I'm with Outland Renewable Energy. We're headquartered in Minnesota. We develop wind and solar projects across the country. We do greenfield and co-development projects, and we also have a field services division, and we service turbines throughout the country. We have more than 60 full-time employees, and we keep growing by the week. Outland was founded by five farmers, Dennis and Bernard Fultz, Larry and Elton Goldman. Dennis is next to me here, and John Nelson, and they all live in southwest Minnesota. And we do community wind projects. We believe that local ownership is a good business model. It brings the community together in supporting the project. Last year, we had a large investor come into our company, and that is Elko Renewable Energy. They're now our largest shareholder. Tom Malone is our CEO and vice chair. And Elko, our parent company, is his company. He has a lot of experience financing large projects. Elko has experience arranging financing for hundreds of millions of dollars of renewable projects and billions of dollars worth of financing for infrastructure projects. Elko is also a principal shareholder in SunEdison, which is the largest solar integrator in the United States. So by having Elko as a major investor of Outland, it's really put us on the map, and we're, under the leadership of Tom, we're able to get the financial capacity to do things like proposing to build our own transmission line. Minnesota, as you probably know, is known for one of the best wind regimes in the country, but we're also known for the worst transmission constraints in the country. There is a tremendous opportunity here in Minnesota for economic development, but the transmission is the biggest barrier in reaching the economic development potential. And I think Claire from MISO talked a little bit about this, but you know, if we have 25,000 megawatts of interconnection requests, but we're only going to add 2,000 megawatts of outlet capacity by 2015, that's a lot of lost opportunity in economic development. And there are a variety of reasons why wind developers do suspend, and we're going to actually be addressing some of those issues. Due to the renewable energy mandates that have been being passed across the country, there's a great need for large amounts of wind. And states are going to need to import, just as what Claire testified as well about the 90,000 megawatt figure is pretty staggering. And utilities, as they testified, that they do have a plan to meet the RES. But the one thing that's kind of different from looking at things from our perspective is that we do wear different hats. You know, the utilities are doing a transmission plan, but they're looking at it from, you know, they're a regulated industry. They're tasked with reliability and providing reliable electricity, and that's very important, obviously. But we're looking at it from a wind developer's perspective, and we're operating in a different marketplace as utilities are. It's a very competitive marketplace. Timing is very, very crucial for wind developers. So we have different priorities, I think, of where transmission should go and the timing of when transmission should get there. Our own experience with our interconnection problems led us to propose our own transmission line. Dennis is going to be talking about one of our projects, Shetek Wind, and about the issue with curtailment that we've experienced. And curtailment is when you have a limitation to deliver electricity due to the unavailability of transmission. So under curtailment, utilities are required to pay wind developers for wind energy that could have been generated but was not deliverable due to transmission. And this has become a pretty big issue for wind developers. Also, another factor is that wind developers sometimes have to pay for their own upgrades. If you're trying to interconnect and you just happen to be in that place in the queue, and the timing is such where you request your interconnection and a large amount of upgrades have to take place in order for you to interconnect. And generators are often asked to pay for these upgrades. And we get about 50% reimbursement, but it still puts us at a competitive disadvantage with other wind developers. So our Minnesota Independence Line is an innovative but obvious solution to this problem we're experiencing. And we plan to move 1,500 megawatts of wind in southwest Minnesota to the Twin Cities from a severely constrained area to an area that is less constrained. Our line is radial, which means it's a one-way line. One of the concerns I've heard about using a one-way line where it's not connected at both ends is that, the kind of vulnerability that there is about injecting large amounts of wind in one area. But we're moving into a new future. There is, with the direction the country is going in, we're going to have to learn how to deal with injecting large amounts of wind in one area. That's just something we're going to have to face and something we're going to have to deal with. We're also not the first developer to propose a private transmission line. This has been taking place in other parts of the country as early as 20 years ago. That was a 213-mile line from Nevada to California to move geothermal electricity. Similar circumstances where they were proposing to build generation where there was a lot of transmission constraint. Again, the other lines have been built. Florida Power Light recently they're doing a private line in Colorado. They're also proposing another private line in Iowa. There is a pathway in FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to exempt these lines from open access. So you're able to, if you will, dedicate the line to renewable energy by having the transmission viewed as part of the generation and necessary to interconnect the generation. With our transmission constraints that are taking place in Buffalo Ridge, there's a very good argument to make that the transmission is really necessary to interconnect, since you can't interconnect large amounts of wind in the Buffalo Ridge at this time. And it could be some time before we're able to do that. So our line would be privately financed, and it would also make large-scale community wind in Minnesota a reality. There are two things I think that kind of slow everything down. One is the MISO queue. And as MISO testified, they are working on an alternative process to that queue. We're active in that process. But we also, I think another aspect is the regulatory climate. You need two permits in Minnesota to do a transmission line, a certificate of need and a route permit. Easing these regulatory requirements or streamlining these regulatory requirements could speed up transmission. As long as also we are kind of streamlining the MISO process and changing the queue process as well. But I think I want to leave you with, it's really important that we're able to develop wind where the best wind is located to make the most out of our economic development potential in Minnesota. And the others. So that's, thank you. So any questions?
I'm formulating some. Let's go on to the next speaker.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. I'm Dennis Foltz. I live in Tracy, Minnesota. I'm a full-time farmer, raising corn, soybeans, and hogs with my father and two brothers. Also as something else to do, I guess, I and four other farmers in the area got involved in trying to develop a wind project on our farm. It has grown, and Ingrid explained a little bit how the company grew and what we're doing now. We have one project we would like to develop. We call it Chetek Wind. And we have about 60 landowners currently who are within our footprint that have chosen to invest in the company. This project will be, the local people in the community will have the opportunity to be an owner in this project. And they, up to this point, they've put in about $700,000 to help us get the studies and the initial development work done. The potential development in this wind farm, we feel, is between 1,200 and 1,500 megawatt. That's a fair amount of power. And it would have to be built over a number of years in various phases. And right now, we're still in the early stages of the project. Basically, our business model for how we work with our neighbors and our friends is a case of, number one, we try to work with our neighbors to build a cost-effective, utility-scale wind farm. And the local landowners have an ownership interest in the project. They share the risks along with the advantages of being an owner. Large international and the national development companies that are currently very active in Minnesota don't offer to the people they're dealing with, the landowners they're dealing with, the opportunity to become an owner in the project. That's something that's unique about Outland. We covet and want local ownership in these projects. And in order to make it feasible for the local landowners to become an investor in the company, all we ask is a $10,000 investment. And for most landowners, that is within their means if they are interested in joining us. And being an investor and an owner in a wind project as a farmer basically just allows you to harvest the wind that is blowing across your fields of corn and soybeans. So it diversifies a little bit your income stream. We actually started the Chetek Wind on a little bit smaller scale, and we actually applied for and got into the MISO queue for 150 megawatts because there was one of these transmission lines that Xcel has just upgraded recently passes close to the project. So we got all the way to the point of actually having a interconnect agreement with MISO. But when we responded to several of the utilities' RFPs, they took a look at our application and they said, gee, we like your wind resource. We like your price. But further study shows us we really can't take you serious yet because there's too much risk of curtailment. There are times during the year or during the windy season we wouldn't be able to put our power on the line because the current lines were filled up. For that reason, we decided, well, if we want to get 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 megawatts online, we might as well build our own line right to where the market is, which is the metro area. So that's basically the concept behind what we're doing. The CapEx 2020 lines that was discussed here earlier, with the way the queue is set up, our project, our Chetek project, would not be able to get any power into that line because other developers who got in the queue before us would have access to that CapEx 2020. We would have to wait until some of the more futuristic projects that are being discussed earlier today till they come online, and we're talking 2016 or later. We feel that Chetek Wind, we don't want to wait that long for Chetek Wind to get online. So that was the reason we chose then to pursue this opportunity or this challenge for us to basically what we're, the concept is, we'd like just to build an extension cord from our wind project up to where the big market is, where there is not congestion on the transmission system. Hook in right into the circuit that services the Twin Cities. So what would be the economic impact of a project of this nature? The line itself would be hundreds of millions of dollars to build, but then to build the 1,200 to 1,500 megawatts of wind towers would be billions of dollars. Now that's capital investment in Minnesota that is going to do numerous things. Number one, it's going to stimulate economic development because once this project is built, it's going to require hundreds of technicians just to maintain the project. There is also for the governmental units in the area, there is a large tax that it actually would be generated by a project of this magnitude. And I don't know how the taxes are broken out, but it will be I know it'd be very good for the local community and the local tax base, governmental taxing units. So there's no reason why we shouldn't do it. And I guess I would finalize my comments by saying that Outland Renewable Energy wants to be a part of the solution to the transmission gridlock we're now facing.
I don't think so.
Thank you. And are there any questions?
I have several.
Don't make them tough.
Let me just start with one comment you made about when the wind is blowing or not blowing, when the wind is blowing, they wouldn't be able to get the projects online. But the question really is whether they go online or they don't go online, right? I mean, it's not something that's intermittent. Either you have a line or you don't have a line.
Okay, Madam Chairman. Curtailment is something that out in the Buffalo Ridge area of Minnesota, southwest Minnesota, when we get these strong windy days when the wind runs at 25 miles an hour over the entire area, already the existing wind turbines that are up, some of those actually have to be turned off because the production capability of the wind turbines that are currently there is greater than what the transmission lines can take it away. If we were to add another 150 megawatts from our project that we were proposing, it would just compound that problem. And since we were one of the last in to the system, they would probably look at us and say, you're the first one to drop out. And because we were facing that dilemma and we couldn't determine what percentage of the time we couldn't produce the power, that we could not finance the project. Because initially when the wind projects were built out on the ridge and got going.
So are you proposing to jump ahead of other projects then?
No, we're not. No.
Maybe you can elaborate on that.
I
mean, you're wanting your electricity purchased.
We're wanting
ahead of the ones who aren't able to be transmitted on the other lines. If you were to put your private line in.
Oh, as Madam Chairman, as I see it, if we put the private line in, we would deliver the power up to the near the suburbs of Minneapolis or St. Paul area here, where there isn't the constriction. The constriction is on the lines that run from between Minneapolis-St. Paul area out to certain substations and out in the more rural areas.
Yeah, I'm not trying to criticize. I'm just trying to really understand this. Can you tell me a little bit more about what a private line is? How does it differ from other lines? They're installed by private companies, too.
Madam Chair, I can probably answer that. About our line in terms of kind of jumping the queue, one of the things that we're very interested in doing is also working with other community-based wind developers and working out an agreement with them where they could also use our line as well. So it wouldn't only just serve us. It would also serve other community wind developers. In terms of the pathway and to do a private line, as I said, it has been done several times, more than several, at least several that I'm aware of, across the country. And you have to deal with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on the private line issue. That's something that they have jurisdiction over. In the case with Oxbow, which was that 214 line from mile line from Nevada to California, they were able to have that transmission line viewed as part of their generation. But at some point later on, FERC did order them to open up that line, and they did have to allow other electricity on that line. FERC does have the authority to do that. So the private line is something that is owned in conjunction with the generating facility. So that's how you're able to do something like that.
I still don't understand, because the other electrical generators also are putting up transmission lines. How are they different than what you're proposing to do?
Well, Madam Chair, the utilities are required to, they have an open access rule. They have to comply with. When they put up a transmission line, they're not necessarily able to even use the transmission line that they put up. Someone else can probably speak a little bit better to that issue than I can, but they can be treated differently by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
So yours would be like a private highway. Only you could use it unless you chose to let others enter it?
In the case of Sagebrush, which was a shorter line, I think a 46-mile line in California, that it was a private line, very similar circumstances, they entered into agreements with other developers, and they kind of shared the line, if you will. But it was still a private line and privately financed, privately owned, and privately maintained.
Okay. Mr. Foltz, you mentioned that you like your landowners to invest about $10,000. What proportion of the project cost is $10,000 generally?
Madam Chairman, $10,000 is a very, very small piece of the project. What the local people are doing is they are funding the initial development, the wind studies, the application into the MISO queue, and all those studies, which are hundreds of thousands of dollars. That we basically, with the $10,000 or more, some people put in more than $10,000, but for the $700,000 that we have raised, it's basically just the seed money to show that the project is feasible and get it potentially interconnected into the system.
Less than a percent?
Of the, if we're talking, let's say, a thousand megawatt project, it is just one tenth of 1%. It's very, very small. But
is a 1,000 megawatt project, would that all be on one landowner's property that you would ask $10,000, or would it be several people that would be involved in that?
Madam Chair, a 10,000-megawatt project would probably be maybe 100 square miles, you know, 100
right.
sections, and you could maybe have 400 to 500 landowners in that particular block of land. Not all of them are going to be ones that chose to invest. We have to work with those landowners, even though they choose not to invest, because they have the wind rights above their land, and we have to buy the wind rights from them.
So do these qualify as seabed projects? Ms. Bjorklund?
Madam Chair, our two initial projects have qualified as seabed. Whether we're able to do a seabed project at this scale, I think remains to be seen, and probably remains to be seen the future of the seabed statute. But I would say the philosophy is something we're going to be taking with us regardless of whether we have a seabed designation for a project of this scale. It's something that's very, very important to us, and we believe it's a business model that really works.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, whoever wants to answer, a couple questions. Are there what prevents you legally from doing this now? Number one, I mean, would you need law changes to do this?
The private line.
Yeah, the private line, number one. And secondly, well, I'm trying to understand, you know, we had a little bit of comment from XL about what the negatives they would see, that it could compete with the corridors that they're trying to work on. But I guess I'm trying to get a better handle on that. And then second question is, when you if you brought the electricity to the Twin Cities and you feed it into the lines, do you have to have a regulated utility buy it and distribute it, or can you just sell it directly to customers?
Ms. Bjorklund.
Hey, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, those are really good questions. I think the Excel representative did bring up a really good point on the chicken and egg that really did resonate with me when she was talking about that. These are really tough issues. Yes, we would ultimately need an off-taker. I mean, you could go merchant to sell the electricity, but I don't know if that's something that would be financially feasible, although it has been done before. In my understanding, and I don't know if it's this is the, for sure the way it's going to happen, but that Florida Power and Light is looking at doing that in Iowa, but that's at this stage on their private line.
Madam Chair, is that
Senator
would
Anderson?
That require a law change to be able to
no,
do that in Minnesota?
No, to do a private line, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, it does not require a law change to be able to do a private line. But I think these issues are so crucial to the state and the direction we go in terms of where we're able to build wind farms. We didn't enter into this business to get into the transmission business. We entered into this business to do a large amounts of wind in southwest Minnesota, where we believe there's a lot of potential for wind. Another thing to add is turbine manufacturers are also requiring, things are getting pretty tough out there, and they're requiring that, you know, for certain turbines that you have certain wind regimes, and you know, it's the best place to do wind development, and we really want to bring that to southwest Minnesota. I think anything that the state could do to make that process easier is a good thing. Whether we're doing the line or somebody else is doing the line to bring more renewables in that area to fruition, I mean, we wouldn't be in the position we're in if the area had been built up in transmission, but the crystal ball probably wasn't there in the early planning stages 10 years ago that we'd be facing this world today.
Okay, let's move on to Mr. Gervais then.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I bring the economic development side to this. I'm Robert Gervais. I'm the economic development director for the city of Tracy. Tracy is a small rural community in southwest Minnesota, population 2,268. We don't have a lot of industry, so to speak. We don't have the big box stores. We're an agriculture-based community. Wind has now become one of those commodities that we can afford to transport, but we need the ability to do that. Hundreds of years ago, the United States built roads and railroads to bring people, to develop the United States, to develop America, and transport people out this way, but also to bring goods and commodities back and forth. Whether it be agricultural goods leaving Tracy now or the potential to transport wind energy, electricity, to the larger markets. It's that conduit, and as Denny referred to, that extension cord. It's that highway or railroad that affords us the ability to transport our goods to the need, to the metro areas. I'm a little greedy, and I would like to get my hands in the pockets of those people living in New York someday by transporting electricity to the grids on the East Coast. The money that's made in Tracy, obviously, as Denny alluded to, the local ownership, the farmers and people in the area that own the land, putting money back into their pockets. As you look at Lincoln County, not too far away from Murray and Lyon counties, one of the poorest counties in the state and the nation, the ability to impact those people in the areas out there with the landowners and putting money every day into their pockets through a renewable energy like wind is a tremendous economic impact. Also, the jobs that would be created through the maintenance positions, typically in Tracy about 3 years ago, the average wage was just over $7 an hour. Not very high. These jobs, probably in the $20-plus dollars an hour wage plus benefits, in the neighborhood of probably 100-plus jobs, a tremendous economic impact. Obviously, too, those jobs are not 70-year-old people climbing up and down towers every day. They're the young, the families. In Tracy, we're developing a standalone child care facility. People that would use those facilities, put their kids in the school, use the hospitals and clinics, the churches, grocery stores, et cetera. It's a sustainability that we need, but we need that ability to export our product. I'd certainly entertain any questions.
Questions at this time?
Thank you.
I'm going to call on Doug Collins. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Senators, appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. I do have a handout, but it's more general information on ITC Midwest.
You're going to have to pull your microphone a little closer, too. Thank you.
As I stated, I do have a handout, but it's more general information on the company I work for. I'm executive director of a company called ITC Midwest. And as was stated earlier, we were formed December of last year with the purchase of the transmission assets, which were formerly owned by Alliant Energy, Interstate Power and Light. Rather than going through some remarks that were prepared, I thought it'd be more instructive to actually comment on some of the things that have been said this afternoon. First, as Mr. Moeller was talking about the queue process and that they were looking at changing that process, certainly there are changes to the queue process that will be useful and necessary, but in my opinion, what they're doing is treating a symptom rather than the problem. You cannot fix the current queue problem by changing the process. You can improve it, but you cannot fix it. The fix to the queue problem is installation of facilities, and I think we've heard that throughout this afternoon. Mr. Moeller is correct. The infrastructure that is needed is substantial. And that's why I think that it's critical that the studies get underway to identify those facilities. I'm encouraged and look forward to the meeting on Friday, which is the kickoff meeting that MISO has to start the identification of those facilities. Mr. Moeller alluded to a critic. I don't view myself as a critic of MISO, but I suspect he was referring to me when he said that the statement had been made that we need to move away from planning by interconnection and start doing long-term planning, looking at all uses of the system. As an industry, about 15 years ago, we did start, in my opinion, to plan by interconnection. As the rules developed at FERC, we looked at how to push off investment rather than to make investment. He talked about he was questioned and he talked about the system looking out to 2012 and that it would be adequate for the current mandates. I would agree with him that indeed what is in the works will make the system adequate for the current RPSs that are known. He also stated that more action was needed in order to meet those mandates for 2016 and for 2025. What I would submit is that as we talk about the mandates, and as Mr. Moeller alluded to, we should look at those as minimums. That to meet those mandates really is the minimum that is needed in order to develop the resource along Buffalo Ridge and elsewhere. As we look at those minimums and as we look at what needs to be planned, it is my opinion that we should try to determine what is the likely development potential of those resources and run our studies looking at what is the end game in order to enable that development. Certainly, as we've heard, wind developers are frustrated. The queue is long. Obviously, the wind developers want to move faster than what we've been able to move on the transmission side of the business or to get them through the queue. Comment on statements that were made by the CapEx team, and I applaud what they have done to date. They stepped up when others were not looking at longer-term planning and put some plans out there and have started to implement those plans. But I think it was instructive that as they were making their statements, at least my perception viewed their statements as kind of centered around their needs, their response to the RPS requirements. I think that that's not a criticism of those statements, but more I think it's instructive to look at the difference in our business models. I work for a company that is a transmission-only entity. We are independent of any market participants. And as we look at the needs for the transmission system, we look at all users and all uses. We would look at what is the development potential rather than what do I need to meet my part of the RPS requirement. And we look forward to working with CapEx as we look forward, as we study what is needed for the future and bringing that perspective. We also look forward to bringing more of a regional perspective. Certainly it's important that the transmission is in place to meet Minnesota's policy goals. But transmission is regional. The governors have recognized that. The states have recognized it. And now it's time for the transmission owners to step up and truly develop the system that is regional. And that means we need to look at the surrounding states as well and what their policy goals are. Ms. Mogensen from Excel talked about the chicken and the egg scenario with transmission and generation. And certainly that has been the case. And I believe that's why we are in the predicament we are with the queue. It's planning by interconnection. I believe that the answer is for the transmission owners and developers, MISO, ITC, CapEx, to step up and declare themselves in the lead. We need to develop that system which is needed. Transmission should not be a bottleneck to development of our resources. It should not be a bottleneck to market efficiency, and it should not be a bottleneck to economic development. It should be the enabler of all of those things. I understand the frustration that Outland is experiencing. Everyone certainly wants to get their project that they have in the queue online and producing. From my perspective, what I would like to see is the transmission owners step up and take the lead. The transmission owners certainly know transmission well. We should be the ones that develop the transmission system, as we do know what we are doing, and we should allow Outland and other wind developers to do what they do best, which is developing the wind power. Like Ms. Mogensen, I am concerned about corridor fatigue, using corridors which could be used for higher voltage, higher capacity lines as a single outlet for a single facility. And finally, one of my prepared comments I will make, and that is that in looking at the various problems that have occurred, there were questions about what drives people to go into suspension. At least we believe part of that is the high cost of network upgrades that generator applicants typically see after studies. On Friday, ITC Midwest filed at FERC an application to change what is known as attachment FF for our footprint, which would change it so that developers of generation, rather than funding 50% of the transmission upgrades, ITC would pick up 100% of those upgrades. We believe that when the transmission system is stretched to the point it is today, that it is unfair to saddle on new generation entrance facilities that should have been developed and installed. And with that, thank you.
Can you say a little bit more about the exclusivity of CapEx? Who else do you think should be involved in that?
If I indicated, Madam Chair, that there was exclusivity. I did not mean to do that. I think that CAPAX has set up an open planning process. We would like to and have been invited to participate in planning the future of the grid. And through that planning process, that will include many stakeholders because it will also use the MISO planning process. It is not an exclusive club.
So maybe you're not the person to ask, but anybody who is a generator in Minnesota could participate in CAPEX, I think even part of Wisconsin, is that right?
CAPEX itself is it's a group of transmission-owning utilities. They stepped up and formed a group which helps to fund and to develop transmission systems. They're really the people to ask about, you know, guidelines. It's really not a company per se. It's really, in my opinion, it's a study slash cost sharing organization.
Mm. Okay. Any questions, Senator Olsen?
Madam Chair, thank you. If your sole mission is transmission, could you address your revenue source and if that source would be regulated or subject to regulation?
Mr. Collins.
Madam Chair, Senator. Yes, our revenue source is transmission service payments, which comes through the Midwest ISO. The rate is FERC regulated and is calculated through what is known as Attachment O, which looks at the revenue requirements of our system divided by the megawatt hours that are expected, and that's administered by the Midwest ISO.
Any further questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Collins.
Thank you.
Beth Soholt.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Beth Soholt with Wind on the Wires. While Jenny gets my presentation up here, I think I'll begin because of the shortness of time. For those of you who don't remember Wind on the Wires, we participated in the Renewable Energy Standard debate last year. We represent wind developers. The two major categories of members at Wind on the Wires are wind developers. We have lots of different kinds of flavors of wind developers, community-based developers, corporate developers, and then our other bucket is environmental partners. We have most of the major environmental organizations in the upper Midwest belong to Wind on the Wires. Our mission is to move wind energy to market, and that the highway to do that is really transmission lines. We do work with the Midwest ISO, MISO, and the thank you, and the utilities and lots of other stakeholders to move transmission for renewables forward. I've got a handout that's going around. I won't spend any time on our background. We've heard a lot of things today, I think, that are pretty common themes, and there's a lot going on, and it's difficult for the committee members who hear about this maybe once or twice during the legislative session, I'm sure, to keep up with what's going on, much different than those of us who work in this day in, day out. So I'll try to provide my remarks in English, not that the others haven't, but pull together a few of the common themes that we've heard today. First of all, I think we need to recognize that passing the Renewable Energy Standard was really the first step. We've got a lot of other steps to go, and that includes a significant amount of transmission to be able to meet the renewable energy goals. But this is something we knew. We knew because we had done a really good, robust wind integration study that showed that we were going to be able to incorporate or integrate up to 25% wind with lower costs than we thought, but that there were some caveats to the wind integration study. We knew we needed significant transmission infrastructure to make the renewable energy standard work. we knew that we needed the MISO footprint, not just the state of Minnesota, but the MISO footprint to sink the wind into. And that's why we need to eventually get beyond looking at just sinking the wind into our state borders and what we need. We need to look at transmission outside of Minnesota or coordinating and collaborating with other states. I think the Outland Renewable presentation is very much a reaction to the lack of transmission and to the frustration that is pretty common among wind developers in the MISO footprint and in Minnesota. We simply cannot do transmission fast enough for the wind developers. When they can put up a wind farm in 6 to 12 months, and many of them have been working on their projects for a number of years, it's only to be expected that they're becoming increasingly frustrated with the lack of transmission. And so despite the many studies underway, I think the things that are in the regulatory process and that have the promise of adding new transmission capacity, one of the messages is it's very important to move those on a timely basis. So let me just make a few comments on the studies that are underway. Many people have alluded to the transmission studies that are underway. We were a bit concerned at first. We loaded a lot on the utilities coming out of the session last year. It took a little while for them to understand kind of where we needed to head, pull together their teams. But we do feel lately they've really embraced what needs to be done and have done some good work on identifying transmission to meet the benchmarks for the RES. But I guess I reserve my judgment to always come back and say, gosh, they're not doing quite as good a job as we hope they would be doing. But so just to comment on the dispersed renewable generation study in particular, I think as Will Call mentioned, that the first phase of that study, there's a report due in June. It's not an either-or. It's not an either that we do dispersed renewable generation or we do large transmission lines. We must do both. And so there hopefully will be some promising results from the study for the first 600 megawatts, but we know at the same time we have to keep multiple things moving forward. One of those things is the CapEx Certificate of Need proceeding, and Wind on the Wires is a party to the proceeding. We believe very strongly that timely construction of these three lines is important for renewables. There are many, many, many projects waiting for the new capacity on these transmission lines. Some of the related activities, you've heard people talk about the queue reform today. We've been very actively involved in the task force at MISO that's doing the queue reform. I think one of the most instructive comments maybe that has come from the task force is Claire Moeller saying the queue reform is not the silver bullet, it'll just change which governors are calling me. So projects will be able to move forward, hopefully, with moving from a sequential processing or first in, first serve to really letting the projects meet milestones and then move ahead, maybe even moving ahead of their sister or brother projects. But the root cause still remains the same, and that's lack of transmission. So it's a helpful near-term thing that we're doing with queue reform, but it's not the silver bullet. We are going to kind of eke out some of the remaining benefits through the queue reform, but then we're going to be back in the same boat. We're going to have lots of megawatts looking for new transmission and looking for transmission to be identified and constructed. So it's a piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole solution. In thinking about really three things that need to be addressed, and that's, you know, good work on studies underway, queue reform, and thinking about what we need to do to go beyond the 2012 and 2016 milestones, this really does get into what other people have identified, and it gets into the larger regional goals and larger goals with the states around us. And really, when you aggregate those number of megawatts, you come up with really big numbers, and that means we need really big solutions. But if you think about the land use for transmission siting and routing, and you think about the economics. We want to do these things right. And so I think CapEx expanding their footprint to bring in Iowa and Wisconsin to talk about what is a multi-state sub-regional MISO solution that's going to work for everybody in the out years. What accommodates our Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard benchmarks in the out years, but what accommodates those other goals in the other states? The governors have really come out and said, we have very aggressive goals, and you can see the kinds of numbers that it really adds up to by 2025. You know, looking at a 20% penetration level across MISO, we're kind of getting to the same kinds of numbers. They're large, and it's going to need a lot of transmission. So that means we really have to think about, as we're developing the next transmission proposals and they come forward in the regulatory process, what is the right voltage level that we should be constructing? It's not going to be enough just to say we're serving Minnesota needs. Wisconsin, for example, is already getting wind delivered from Minnesota and from Iowa to satisfy their renewable portfolio standard. They're having an enormous amount of difficulty siting wind in Wisconsin for a number of reasons, and they're looking to other states to help them fulfill their renewable portfolio standard. And so Minnesota can be an exporter. We can go beyond satisfying our renewable energy standards here and ship it to other states where it makes sense. So encouraging the utilities to look at large enough solutions and maximizing the use of corridors the first time rather than doing it multiple times, I think, are very important messages. Many people have alluded to the kickoff workshop on Friday for the MISO Regional Generation Outlet Study, another very important study that is going to be take a multi-state look at what we need to do from a transmission perspective. MISO does have an open planning process. Any stakeholder is welcome to come to the meetings. Those are coordinated with things that the utilities are doing. It's coordinated with the independent independent transmission companies are doing. And it is a venue for people to really come and give their input. So I think to go back to kind of the themes that I wanted to stress today, we believe that the utilities are doing a good, solid job to date of really embracing what needed to be done coming out of the passing the renewable energy standard. That may or may not hold true in the future, but we think for right now we see them on a good trajectory to bubble up what needs to be done. We think that the problems with the MISO queue, which I know you all have heard a lot about, may or may not get better with the queue reform. And you know, some of the things that they're talking about in the queue reform may be unwittingly creating barriers for wind developers. For example, if you want to add more certainty to knowing projects will get through, but you raise the deposits or you raise the financial commitments that projects are having to make to get through, that may or may not actually make projects get through any quicker. And so there are specifics in the queue reform process that we're concerned about and may or may not be raising those at FERC. Being able to only suspend your project for force majeure, an act of God, something that's totally out of your control, when you can suspend 3 years right now, is probably not the way to go. There are so many pieces that have to come together in doing a wind project that being able to suspend for 6 months or 9 months while you're waiting to see if you won an RFP, a utility RFP, is not a force majeure event, but it's something that you wait for, and to have to be, you know, go back to the end of the queue and work your way through again is probably not the right answer. So there are a couple details in the queue reform that we're concerned about, but we'll be working on those in the MISO venue and then filing comments with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to plead our case there. So, Madam Chair, those are my remarks, and I would be glad to answer any questions.
Ms. Solholt, are the problems that we are encountering with Midwest transmission similar in other parts of the country?
There are actually queue issues in quite a few other parts of the country. California has a very backlog queue. Texas has taken a little more proactive approach on their CREZ process, their competitive renewable energy zones, and identifying transmission, having companies bid for that transmission capacity, putting up financial deposits for that transmission, and are moving transmission forward. But I think it's too early to tell whether that process is actually quicker, faster, or more cost-efficient than what we're doing here. There's no I think it's fair to say that this stuff takes a long time and that we will always be in a catch-up mode with transmission and wind, unfortunately. But I also think that we're not going to stop trying to push the utilities as fast as we can to identify these. And perhaps something that might be important for your committee to look at next year would be, are there regulatory processes that can be streamlined or shortened, keeping the environmental protections, keeping the things that are very important, but are there ideas, ways that we can shorten our regulatory process for approval of transmission that would serve the renewable energy standard?
We have been looking at some of those. We looked at the possibility of the Public Utility Commissions meeting jointly across states to be able to site transmission lines, but we haven't a solution yet.
Madam Chair, if I just might add, I think that we believe, as well as a lot of people that you've heard from today, that the governor's support of the renewable energy standards and realizing that we need transmission infrastructure is a very important piece. That needs to trickle down to implementation by the utilities and you know, answer some of the cost recovery issues for the state regulators. And we're going to be doing some work on kind of a uniform message across, you know, what are best practices, what are some of the best solutions. But it is a regional issue as well as a state issue. Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Holtz, do you have any idea how much wind is not utilized right now? How much megawatts are? The rumor is that is a lot of it is buried. We generate it, and a lot of it's buried out in the southwest corner. Do you have any idea how much is not utilized?
Ms. Soho.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, do you mean from a resource, like how much wind resource do we have, or do you mean projects that are currently in the queue that just can't come to fruition, or could you clarify your question a little bit?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mainly the towers that are up that are generating how much of their energy is that's generated is not being utilized on the transmission line. It has to be buried because of the lack.
Ms. Soholt.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, now I understand.
Yeah.
it would be something like I believe Senator Carlson asked for how much is getting curtailed, you know, how much of the potential from the wind towers that are up and operational are we not seeing delivered to customers? The utilities might be able to answer that better than I could. I think a couple years ago we were having severe curtailment issues because of lack of transmission. I think we've moved towards being able to utilize a lot more of that wind, if not all of it. But it's certainly an issue that the utilities keep looking at. And one thing, you know, they have to balance. Should they be purchasing wind when the production tax credit is available and you know, pay some curtailment costs while they wait for the transmission to be constructed? They do those cost-benefit trade-offs and figure out what the best thing for consumers is at the end of the day. But we can certainly follow up and see how much of the wind is not being utilized. I'm not aware that there's a significant curtailment issues because Xcel has been working on finishing the Southwest Minnesota project that will bring us up to 825 megawatts. But we can certainly follow up.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
And I'm sorry, I missed that question with Senator Carlson. But and the reason I ask that is because there are those rumors. I live in southern Minnesota.
and also what Mr. Foltz did say about having to turn off some of those large turbines that are running when the wind is going, and they have to turn them off because there's no way to move that energy. So it is kind of an interesting figure that we should probably have, just to see how much we are wasting.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Ms. Soholt.
Senator Rosen, just one final thought. I think that Xcel does have, I just mentioned Xcel because they're the largest purchaser right now, I think that they do have kind of a pro-rata curtailment, kind of a round-robin curtailment that they use with wind projects, simply that it makes it equitable for everybody, if they have transmission issues. But that's an Xcel operating issue we could probably provide an answer for.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Would you speak to a fairly simple question that I'm sure has a lot of complexity to it from the provider, and that is, what would be some of the issues as to why we wouldn't support private investment in transmission lines if it can move wind to a source that can utilize it so that we're not wasting wind energy, which is a renewable energy source that has fewer problems for the emissions? Why wouldn't we do that? What would be two or three reasons why we would stop building highways if it was stopping our businesses from being able to get their products built and out and sold? Isn't that the critical question here, whether we're going to go out some kind of a matrix that's being planned and moved forward in an incremental way that delays our capacity to utilize a resource, especially in southern Minnesota, and a potential industry and job creation in southwestern Minnesota? Mm-hmm. We're talking about speeding that up because there's somebody willing to put some money in the process to make it happen faster. What's the problem with that?
Ms. Soholt.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon. I think there's a couple things, and I'm not taking a position whether it's good or bad. I'm just simply trying to inform the committee members about the complexities. First of all, I think you need to look at the economic efficiency of doing that and the operating efficiency or the operating impacts. So those two issues, let's take the operating impact first. Wind developers proposing their own transmission, again, is out of frustration from things moving so slowly, I think, and feeling like they have no alternative but to propose transmission. So from an operational perspective, at some point that even if it's part of their wind farm development, so it's an interconnection piece rather than a transmission piece. There's a distinction between whether it's considered an interconnection piece or a transmission piece. It's got to hook into the transmission grid at some point. So there will be an impact to the transmission system, and the utilities need to understand what that impact is to their system. From an operating perspective, from a load flow perspective, from many different perspectives. We haven't really encountered and thought about that yet. We haven't ever had really a fully fleshed out proposal for somebody to independently build transmission. So there's a lot of questions around that whole issue of how does independent transmission or wind developer transmission impact the operation of our current transmission grid. So that's one issue. Second of all, if a wind developer builds their own significant transmission, they need to put that into the cost of their project. Now, maybe that's less economically efficient than having the system built out for multiple users and then the developer pays their share of that broader developed system. So it may or may not be more or less economically efficient for somebody to build their own transmission. So that's the financial aspect. And just a third would be, unless you're a utility in the state of Minnesota, you won't have eminent domain. You don't have the power to condemn land. And so the wind developer would have to put that cost back into their project. And it may or may not make their project more expensive than somebody else's. And so, you know, only a utility who's doing something that's in the public interest or is a public good has the ability to have eminent domain. And so that would be something that what the wind developer would also have to work through as they're doing their transmission line. So those are just three things to think about. I'm not saying that at the end of the day it might not make sense for something like this to go forward. It's just that I think, as Ms. Bjorklund has found out, it's a pretty complex issue.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Next speaker, George Crocker.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Rosen.
I want to say thank you for this hearing. I think it's been very informative.
Thank you.
Very good hearing.
I have found it so, too, although I've got more questions now than I had before. Mr. Crocker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll see if we can't create even more questions for you here.
Okay.
My name is George Crocker. I'm the Executive Director of the North American Water Office. With me is Mike Michaud, who's been working as well to help address some of the issues that you've been struggling with here. I just have a couple comments that I'd like to make first, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Michaud, and I'll be here for questions if there are any afterwards. But what I'd like to do is help members put these issues that we've been struggling with more in a context that I think might help you understand why we're having these issues at this point in time. We're in the midst of a utility industry that is changing extremely rapidly. The old way of doing business was essentially central station. It was a relatively few, very large remote generators serving the loads, the cities, over a relatively few, very high-voltage power lines. And to the extent that we developed a high-voltage system, it was primarily for reliability purposes. In case one of those or two of those very big central station generators went out, we could fill in the gap because we had the high-voltage transmission to do it. What we have now is a paradigm shift going on where increasingly we're seeing larger numbers of smaller increments of generation, of technology that comes out of factories, of widgets, if you will. Now, it's possible to put a lot of widgets in the same place and then you still have the same central station issues. But the paradigm is shifting. And the problems that you've been hearing about today are because virtually all of the testimony you have heard is attempting to fix new paradigm problems with old paradigm thinking. And so to talk a little bit about the specifics of how that is playing out right now in the decision-making process will be the information that Mr. Michaud is going to provide you.
Mr. Michaud.
Thank you, George. Madam Chair, my name is Mike Michaud. I work as a consultant with the North American Water Office. You're going to hear the beat of a different drummer here than you've heard from previous speakers. And I'm going to start out by sounding an alarm bell about the dangerous situation we're in terms of that we're about to make resource decisions on long-term transmission infrastructure before we have all the necessary data that's appropriate to make those kinds of decisions. And I'm specifically referring to the CapEx Certificate of Need docket. But to lay the framework for our concerns, I want to point out that the CapEx vision study was developed back in 2004 and finished in 2005. It was done by an exclusive club of members, a special interest called the CapEx Transmission Owning Utilities. They invited no one else to their table. They brought the study, after they finished it for the first time, to the Public Utilities Commission. So there was no stakeholder involved in framing the scope of what they studied or what sort of assumptions they made going into that study. In the short 4 years since they did that work, things have changed dramatically. For example, they use the forecast load growth assumptions of 2.6%. Now recent resource planning filings are showing that we can expect load growth down in the range of 1% or less. The study was done assuming that we only needed 10% wind, and that wind was concentrated in big clumps and located long distances from the load centers in Minnesota where we might use those. Our approach is that we shouldn't be looking at the future through a rearview mirror by assuming that things are going to be in the future the way they were in the past. As George mentioned, there's a paradigm shift in technology. There's a paradigm shift in the regulatory structure at the federal level. There's lots of forces in play, including the wonderful RES goals and the DSM requirements that you folks passed last session that are affecting what our future transmission infrastructure needs are going to be. Our approach is that we should look at maximizing the use of the existing transmission infrastructure first and then figure out what cost-effective strategic enhancements we might need to go beyond utilizing to the fullest extent possible our sunk investment in already existing facilities. We believe there is significant undeveloped potential in the existing system using dispersed generation strategies to site new generation resources. We see the need for high voltage transmission lines coming out of the physical distance that separates the location of the generation from the load it's intending to serve. So to the extent that you can site generation near load at an appropriate size that fit the load, you can avoid the need for new transmission. Planning is just now beginning for our new RES goals. We've got new DSM technical tools coming down the line. The MISO market, for example, is just starting to integrate demand-side structures into its market. We've got lots of innovation on the supply side coming down the pike. We've got fuel cells. Photovoltaic costs are declining rapidly. All of a sudden, concentrated solar plants have popped up in the 100 megawatt size scale in the southwest of the U.S. How long before they're cost-effective in Minnesota? And we're looking at storage technologies like vehicle-to-grid systems that use hybrid cars to take care of emergencies on the grid for us. Many of these products are at the near term and very close to commercialization. And if you think about what's happening in the longer trend, the future role of the grid will be primarily as a backup power source for local areas. Right now we rely on it as primarily our only power source. But that role is shifting as we can move to these new supply-side technologies that can be distributed everywhere. So we're hoping that we can see a statewide analysis of the transmission needs going forward, taking a look at utilizing existing infrastructure, looking at the socioeconomic benefits of seabed, the possible penetration levels of technology, including DSM. The amount of DSM potential is huge. We need to consider that new baseload plants are going to come with new technologies. You heard earlier that coal-fired plants, you can't turn them down too far or else they get into reliability problems. Well, maybe in 15 years, once we shut those plants off, they should stay off. There are lots of ways to incorporate storage technologies with intermittent resources like wind to create baseload-type characteristics operationally. And these are the kinds of things that need to go into the planning studies. And last but not least is the fossil fuel price impacts on future energy demand. We're going to see an increasing decoupling of gross domestic product from the peak demand of our energy system as the cost of energy increases. And, in fact, it may not even be there in some fuel types. Our key question about what's going on with the CapEx project is, who pays and who benefits? And it's no secret that both North Dakota and South Dakota want to develop their generation resources to serve eastern MISO energy market. Both states openly want to develop thousands of megawatts. move it through Minnesota on new high-voltage transmission lines like the CapEx Group 1 facilities, which, by the way, start in North Dakota, South Dakota, and end up in Wisconsin, to make these kinds of power market transactions happen. Minnesota can be viewed as a pass-through state for this kind of market activity, but the question is, who pays? Under the present MISO cost allocation policies, at least 75% of the cost of the CapEx lines would be allocated to Minnesota utility loads. How much of the energy that flows on those lines is going to be passed through the state to the eastern parts? You heard about Wisconsin needing renewable energy from Minnesota. How much should Minnesota subsidize this energy passed through by paying for the infrastructure? Dispersed generation, as you've heard, is under study right now in the dispersed generation process. We did a study in west central Minnesota with the CapEx utilities a couple years ago. We found out we could do 1,400 megawatts in a dispersed manner, deliver it to Minnesota load during peak summer hours for an investment of less than $100 million in infrastructure. That infrastructure was mostly lower voltage transmission improvements, lots of reconductorings. No high voltage transmission line construction was needed to deliver that 1,400 megawatts just from the west central zone in the state. Now, that amounts to like $70 a kilowatt of new generation compared to almost $400 a kilowatt for the 400 megawatts that were enabled by the 345 line down in southwest Minnesota from Lakefield to Fox Lake, or excuse me, from Sioux Falls to Lakefield. There's an error in my written document there. We've got hundreds of substations in Minnesota already built, already connected to the high-voltage transmission system, and these are on-ramps that can result in many, many megawatts of dispersed generation having access to the transmission grid. Based on the level of penetration that we studied in the west central zone and the level of penetration we've seen in the southwest zone, if we extrapolate that to the rest of the state, we could see as much as 5,000 megawatts of generation being possible to develop and utilized in Minnesota, mainly by using strategic new lower voltage transmission lines. Now, I'm going to put in a caveat here. We need to study this. We need to model this. But there's nothing that we've seen in the evidence that's been generated by the study work so far would say that this is not true. But I'll also say that we need to do this more study work to verify the outcome. The ongoing dispersed generation sweet spot study will identify the transmission costs associated with another 1,200 megawatts of dispersed generation. The first 600 megawatts of that you'll get reported on in June. You've heard from Mr. Call that there's surprisingly good results from that study. They are ongoing. But I'll tell you, we've had some utilities that have been reluctant to look at studying dispersed generation as a strategy for meeting future needs. For example, trying to get study work going to look at how we're going to meet the 2016 goals without CapEx has been a very difficult problem to try to get the necessary analytical work done. Now, you've heard that we can do 2010 and 2012 goals probably without a substantive new transmission from the utilities. And I would postulate that given what the 2016 goal is, that we can probably do the 2016 goal without the CapEx lines too if we do it in a dispersed manner. So this is the kind of study work that needs to happen in order to determine what is the least cost way for us to meet the needs of Minnesota citizens without spending too much money on unnecessary transmission. I'll close quickly by mentioning the MISO queue, which you've heard a lot about, and how the queue reforms may or may not resolve that. I do want to point out that there are interconnections that are possible to be done without going through MISO. under state jurisdiction. We have some state jurisdiction in place already in the distributed generation rules. Those are overly restrictive in terms of what the range of the state authority is, and so we have an opportunity to incentivize interconnections by fully utilizing what's possible under state jurisdiction. And we should be looking at how we can manage retail tariffs, such as a seabed tariff, under state jurisdiction, where the energy would be delivered to the local load-serving utility to totally bypass the MISO queue process and speed up development of seabed-type projects with lots of economic local development attributes for the state of Minnesota. And with that, I'll stop and take questions.
A little bit mind-boggling. Any questions? I'm thinking you're sort of saying that we don't really need to look at more transmission lines because we'll have other ways of storing energy in the future that will be closer to this, to the places that they will be needed. And so we have greater need for distribution lines, but not the transmission lines. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Madam Chair, not quite.
Okay. Correct me.
There is no doubt we need more transmission. And there is no doubt that in some point in time, maybe in the relatively new future, we will need new high voltage transmission. The issue is what set of new transmission, of new high voltage transmission do we do? And how do we inform the decision making about it? Right now, what we've done is we've preempted that decision by saying this is the set, the CapEx set of high voltage that we're going to do, and then the low voltage has to try and figure out how to keep up with that. That's backwards. If we develop the low voltage system first and watch the development that happens, you've heard about the chicken and egg here repeatedly. We know what comes first. The low voltage comes first. Then you know where your eggs are, or maybe where your chickens are. But you know where the development is happening to deliver it to market. And then you develop your high voltage system with the intelligence that you've gained from where the lower voltage development that happens quickly, that's its advantage. If it can happen now, that gives us the time to do the planning and the actual construction to bring the higher voltage system forward.
Okay.
That's the difference.
So why do you think it's not being done that way?
It's old paradigm thinking attempting to struggle with new paradigm questions. It's an institutional blockage that we have because for decades we haven't had to struggle with distributed generation in any sort of a large-scale utility application. Now it's here. So it's a huge challenge. We would, by the way, echo Will Call's enthusiasm for the sweet spot study, the distributed generation analysis. We're very encouraged that the utilities are seeing value from that analysis. They were surprised by it. I wasn't. That's the difference.
Other questions? Well, then I thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Stir the pot a little bit more.
Yes.
And our last speaker is Edward Garvey. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will briefly manage the next 3.5 hours.
All right.
Was that, did I misread? Did you say 3.5 hours or 3.5 minutes?
3 seconds.
3.5 seconds. Madam Chair, I can sum that up in basically in seven words. A rising grid lifts all electrons, and we desperately need to raise our grid.
All right, meeting adjourned. Good.
I can elaborate if you wish.
Yeah, explain a little bit.
Negative ghostwriter.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, transmission really is the Achilles heel of much of our energy policy right now. We need to increase our transmission capabilities for three reasons: for reliability reasons, for economic dispatch reasons, and for environmental delivery reasons. Reliability is clear to keep the lights on. Economic is because you want to basically have a grid system that allows for the lowest cost, highest, most environmentally superior energy sources to be able to get to load. Right now there are congestion spots that inhibit that. And of course, you've heard much testimony already on the need for additional transmission to deliver the wind resource to load. In many respects, you've already heard that we need additional transmission. We need additional transmission in large scales. We have upwards to 800 miles of transmission, 345 kV lines and above, being already proposed. We need an additional 700 miles or so lines also. And when I talk about this, you heard Will Call speak about that we have it figured out for the next 8 years. I don't disagree with that. Having said that, in the last 27 years, we've only had one large 345 kV line sited and built in the state. And that's the one along the I-90 corridor down in southwest Minnesota. That was done in 1981. It took a long time for that to get built. The CapEx lines that you hear that are going in, they started their planning 2 years ago. They now have their regulatory filings. They're now starting to work through the process. That'll take another period of time, and then they'll be constructed. And so you need to start planning now for the next phase of transmission lines. In many respects, the state of Minnesota has not only been on the forefront of its energy policy in the past several years, and the promotion of the renewable energy standards and those kind of things, that does put pressure on the transmission grid and the need for additional transmission. But we've also been on the forefront of some of the transmission promoting policies. I do think it's worthwhile noting that, and I don't think any of the other witnesses have talked about that. We did, and I think, Senator Dibble, you'll remember that we did consolidate the siting and routing responsibilities with the policy components at the Public Utilities Commission back in 2005. It's one of the points where you sort of brought those two things together. I think you, by bringing them together, you actually promote more efficient processing of those kinds of applications. We have a better transmission planning where the utilities are routinely, annually, and then every biannually filing their transmission plans and telling themselves and the public and, more importantly, us as regulators and overseers of them where they need additional transmission resources and capabilities. We've given them greater cost recovery ability so that some of the financing components of transmission are being put in place. And those are good, but we can do more. Let me mention, if I will, five things that we should be thinking about over the interim for the next coming legislative session. The promotion of renewable energy zones and corridors. They identify, we know where the high wind resource capabilities are. And we know, on a map what kind of corridors we'll need. We should start be looking at those kinds of concepts to eliminate some of the regulatory barriers. You create the zones, you create the corridors, you build in them, you reduce your regulatory burdens. Those are the kinds of policies that I think we can be thinking about. The development of smart grids and raising the intellectual capability. And this is more of putting more computer capacity on the grid, both at the grid levels and at the distribution levels, can provide a lot of benefit. You're seeing some of those capabilities in some of the other parts of the country, and Xcel is one of the leading utilities in the country on the smart grid in some of their other jurisdictions. But we can do that here, too, both at the high voltage level, but certainly at the lower voltage level. You've also sort of did hear from Mr. Crocker and Mr. Mashad on some of the low voltage opportunities. I don't disagree with some of those low voltage opportunities. We're working and looking at those. At the same time, I think I do disagree with them on where the chicken and the egg is, and I do think that you do need to start with the high voltage area and then go down, because the low voltage areas aren't necessarily where the best wind regimes are. But those are the kinds of things that we'll be looking at in greater detail with some of the studies that we have. I think we've heard some talk about using our right-of-ways better. Not necessarily the specifics, and we talked about the capability, and I think some of the testimony was correct. You don't want to overload and create reliability threats by overloading a right-of-way. But we have right-of-ways around the country, around the state, that I think we can use more efficiently and better. I've already talked about it, but I do want to reiterate, plan now. And I'm talking about planning now not only for 345 kV lines, but 500 kV lines, and maybe even the 765s. Because you do want not only we have resources here that aren't just for Minnesota, but they're for other places in the country. And that's both to our benefit and to their benefit if we do it in a right way, if we do it in a way that's sharing and appropriate for Minnesota and for the rest of the country. Not that I'm advocating necessarily for all that automatically for that, but I want to make sure that that's on the table and we think about that. But you need that planning now because it takes time and it takes money. We're talking about billions of dollars of investments. And someone's going to pay for that, and most of that payment is going to come from the ratepayers. And we need to make sure that the ratepayers are managed, have those costs managed for them in appropriate least cost, fairly apportioned way. Finally, I think we need to understand that we're not an island. I just talked briefly about the interconnection capabilities of 765s and that kind of capability, but transmission constraints that affect Minnesota may not be in Minnesota. They may be in other portions of the upper Midwest. We need to appreciate and understand that those kinds of things are in interplay here. Likewise, an impact in Minnesota may have a consequence in Iowa. Understanding those kinds of components, and we're starting to do that. The suggestion that was we start sort of looking with the states, Wisconsin, Iowa, Dakota, North and South Dakota, et cetera, start thinking about that on a basis. It's important and a good suggestion that we've been exploring. So, Madam Chair, I know I've used over my 3.5 minutes, but I did want to sort of touch quickly on those bases. And thank you very, very much for holding this hearing. I completely agree with Senator Rosen. This was a very important meeting because having you better understand the importance of transmission and appreciating that it really is the Achilles heel of our overall energy policy and understanding and helping us as regulators and policymakers, as industry entities, to figure this one out is going to be very, very important to the ARC success in the coming years.
Director Garvey, I understand you're holding stakeholder meetings around transmission. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I also have the title of Acting Reliability Administrator.
Oh, I can never figure out what to call you.
You know, Eddie works just fine, ma'am. Every quarter, as the Reliability Administrator, I do convene a public stakeholder meeting to basically talk about these kinds of questions. We had the first one on in January 23rd, we'll have the next one on April 23rd. They're down at the Public Utilities Commission. It's from 1:30 to about 3. We will be sending out the agenda to all of the folks probably later this week. But we sort of bring up a lot of these kinds of issues. It's a way to get all the folks, and many of the ones that have testified before you, to talk to one another. It's for us to sort of share information. And candidly, it's an opportunity for me to sort of push on some of my thoughts, of which I've shared with you today.
Acting Reliability Administrator Garvey. Maybe I should just call you Mr. Garvey. Are you dealing with some of the same transmission issues that we've been talking about today? Or is it a different purpose?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, exactly. Updates on where we are, updates on studies that we're conducting, updates on where we're going, both in the long term and the near term, occur at these meetings.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions or comments, Senator Alcyn?
I know it's late, but when Mr. Crocker talked about. North and South Dakota just running lines through Minnesota. We heard earlier testimony, wouldn't there be some, like a wheelage charge or some kind of charge that money just wouldn't be, Minnesota infrastructure power companies wouldn't be paying just for that a transmission line for power to go through the state, wouldn't there be some revenue captured from the power going through there?
Mr. Garvey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Olsen, without getting beyond my very limited knowledge base, someone like Claire Moeller would be actually the best person for you to sort of understand it. But yes, there are constructs for the revenue sharing and the prices that utilities and energy consumers pay for the use of the transmission lines, and it's apportioned in ways to assure, at least at the time that they were created, a fair and equitable distribution of the costs and benefits of the lines for that. What I think we're starting to see now is the need for a reexamination, if you will, of those apportionments, because in the day George indicated, it was a hub and spoke. I mean, you sort of knew, you knew where things were being built, and you knew where they were going, and while they were regional, they were still within a manageable and an identifiable zone. We're now starting to think about maybe a wider scope with more third parties involved and third party beneficiaries and more distant beneficiaries. So you need to look at your financing a little bit differently than we have perhaps in the past.
Thanks. Senator Dipple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ed.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Do you, are you sorting through some of the issues that were raised earlier in the hearing, the issues raised by Outland and ITC and others, how we raise the capital, how we build the transmission lines, who gets to use it, the implications for the various corridors, and do you have a position, or are we sorting through a position, developing a position, do we need a position, or is state statute sufficient to deal with that already, those issues?
Mr. Garvey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Dibble, representatives of Outland have given my staff a quick briefing, and it's my understanding that they've also given a quick briefing to the Public Utilities Commission. They have not filed anything formal with the either the commission or with my staff. So to the extent we've been having discussions with them, it's been in sort of more general forms such as this, and not having had sort of the formal filing to do sort of what I would characterize a deep analysis by the smart people on my staff or the commission staff.
So we'll have more,
Senator Dipple.
More conversation.
Very much so.
All right. We'll pick up at 6 o'clock p.m. tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you. I think this is likely to be the last meeting this year of the Energy Committee, so I would like to thank the committee members for your participation and the staff for your support and for keeping us organized and informed, and all the testifiers who have really been informative and instructive and helped us to do our jobs. Thank you, and see you next year.
See you next year.
Committee adjourned. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I just, for the members who are still here, next week there will be a joint hearing, I think, of the environment committees, but I've asked for all of us to be notified. Do you know about this? For the fuel standard, there's going to be an informational hearing on the fuel standard bill.
Senator Sharon, we're sending a
notice
out.
So I'm just hoping that you'll all come if you possibly can. Gee.